Hi, this is Caillou's dad, Boris, and you're listening to a podcast where nostalgia comes alive. It's Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show. Roll it!
Welcome to Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show, the podcast where nostalgia comes alive. Since July of 2021, Jake and his friends have interviewed professionals in the worlds of acting, directing, writing, puppeteering, and many more. Who will they be chatting with in this week's interview? Find out in this Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show episode.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show, where nostalgia comes alive. Have you here with us? Thank you for joining. As always, I'm your host, Jake Duffenbaugh. Who are you today? How are you, my friend?
Doing good, Jake. Our other co-host, Matt Bingle, he will try to join later on. He's just running a little bit late, but no worries. He will try and make it soon. And our guest for today, we're very happy. He is an Australian voice actor. He has lent his voice to Popeye, Homer Simpson. He narrated the George of the Jungle movies. He worked on the Blinky Bill franchise, a whole bunch of other things that we'll touch base on later on. And here he is, Keith Scott. Keith, happy to have you here. How are you?
It's great to be here, chaps, and thank you so much for asking me, all the way from down under in Australia.
Our pleasure.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. So to start this off, so for those who don't know you, could you tell our audience a little bit about yourself and the type of work that you do?
Yeah, really. You know, all my life, I guess for like, I'm an old guy, obviously. So like for 45 years, I was doing most of my work based in where I was born and live in Australia, but it was always in the animated cartoon field. And when I was like 18 years of age, it was like I had an angel hover over me and hit me with the wand, because William Hanna from Hanna-Barbera opened a branch of his studio in Sydney, Australia, and I had already written to his chief voice man, the late Doss Butler, who I'm sure you know about. It was the voice of Yogi Bear and Huckleberry Hound and all of those great old Hanna-Barbera characters. And so I took that letter in to meet Bill Hanna. And the upshot of it was that he knew that I was really interested in, being the next generation of cartoon voice actor. And he gave me a job around this animation studio when I was, in my late teens, just to learn the whole business. And it was just one thing after another after that. It was like at the same time I'd written to Doss Butler, I'd written to June Foray, the voice of Rocky the Flying Squirrel and all the other Jay Ward cartoons. And she had put me onto a guy in Southern California who really was just like a year younger than me, named Corey Burton, who you may have heard of, who's become great voice actor. And he and I, in those way before the modern technology, we ended up being snail mail friends,
Oh, nice.
And became, very, I think we were the biggest Jay Ward Productions fans in the world in those days. And of course, again, it's to your generation, it must seem a bit quaint to think back that there was only four TV channels in both countries, and now there's, hundreds and hundreds. But, we became very erudite friends about all of this stuff. And of course, he was still in high school and I just left high school. So we were really possibly, I don't know if this is a fact, but we were possibly the first of that generation who wanted to be the next Mel Blanc, June Foray, Doss Butler type voice actors. And the funny thing was that all these great actors back in those days who are now the all-time legends, I can remember my mother saying, "Oh, these people will never have time. They're too busy to even answer your letter." And every one of them couldn't have been better. They were enthusiastic about, meeting us in person. And so it's almost like they could sense that we were so knowledgeable about what they did that we were definitely going to take over once they retired or passed away, So that was my background, And fortunately, when Bill Hanna in Sydney, before he left to go back to the back to Hollywood, he gave me a reference letter. And because his name carried such weight in the industry, it got me an agent in Sydney straight away. So from about the age of 19-20, I was starting to be a professional cartoon voice actor and just a voiceover guy doing radio and television commercials. And at the same time, because I did all these impersonation voices, I also had it was sort of like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. There was two sides of me. One side did all these voiceover recordings, and the other side was doing this stand-up impressionist thing on stages in clubs every weekend, doing all the old movie stars and political voices and all of that on stage. Sort of like, who would you say, Rich Little or John Biner or people like that, who... I guess these days they've kind of more been replaced by people on the on YouTube and that, who are doing their own videos, and younger mimics doing well. I suppose there's still characters like that who are known by every generation, like Trump and Biden and people like that. So back in the day when I started out, I was doing Richard Nixon and characters like that. So it's just been a long career with all of these zany voices and things, and that really is my background, and it was so busy for a long time, because it's I'm rapidly approaching retirement age now, but it really was a 45-year career of doing all this stuff. And I finally got to some sort of prominence internationally when the people who did the Bullwinkle and all of those cartoons began dying just from old age, and by then their family knew about me and Corey Burton, and we both ended up being, I think, the first ever what they now call voice matchers. We replaced the originals and tried to be as accurate and authentic as we could. And so I couldn't believe it, but I ended up being the official American voice of Bullwinkle for 20 years. And that was like a childhood dream come true, because that was one of those cult TV shows that I just loved when I was a kid. Oh, it was kind of The Simpsons. Yeah, definitely The Simpsons of its day. In fact, it was actually really 30 years too early for the type of humor that is valid today, because it was doing that sort of crazy, irreverent sort of stuff way back when most cartoons were just cats chasing mice. Here's Rocky and Bullwinkle talking about Congress in Washington and the Cold War and all of that. So you can imagine what they were doing with today's headlines.
Definitely.
Right.
So yeah, that's my, and of course, I don't know whether you know about the Blinky Bill. You mentioned that, but that was a lot of local animation here that before the age of the internet wasn't really known. But now I think, everything that's ever been made will end up on YouTube one day.
Right. Yeah.
It's definitely. Just been an amazing advent of technology. And in fact, it helps people like me. Years ago, we used to have to make a recording and carry it with us to prove to some advertising director that we could do an impersonation of Vincent Price or one of these actors. And now you just dial up YouTube in the studio and there's a clip, and you can just listen to it and get a bit of reference in your headphones and make sure it's authentic. So, I'm just sort of happily embracing all of these new technological advances. But that's my story at great length. I hope that sort of filled you in as to what I do.
Nice.
Awesome. So I'm kind of curious, do you remember your very first professional voiceover job?
Yeah, it was actually for Hanna-Barbera in Australia. They were promoting the fact that they'd set up this studio, and he said, you want to do voices. He said, we've got a little animated thing to sell our own wares to this country. And it was a little, character bouncing on screen with this little high-pitched voice and suddenly morphing into a big physically fit announcer. And it was a kind of a parody of one of those huge voices, the ones who do the Oscars, from the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, that sort of voice. And so it was, I can remember it to this day. It was late 1972, when your parents probably weren't even born. And I can still remember, I had to say, Hanna-Barbera Super Animation solves communication problems. And it was almost like Gary Owens, who used to be the announcer on Laugh-In with his hand on his ear saying, "From beautiful downtown Burbank." So yeah, that was the first one. And then after that, it just, like a lot of young people who get into that, it took a, you know, another 3 years before I had anything like regular work, because then you've got a, two things are against you. You look so young that a lot of the people in advertising then said, oh, he couldn't possibly do all these voices. And then the other thing was, you just have to get your name around a whole country. And in those days, it used to involve, you know, a demo tape on actual reel-to-reel tape, that a lot of people used to walk the streets and go to each building where there was an ad agency or a casting director and just hand physical copies of these little reel tapes out. And they used to have shelves of all these actors' voices in alphabetical order. And that was the way it was done in those days. It was sort of like the old Broadway actors who used to pound the pavements and knock on all the producers' doors. But then you finally start getting a few jobs, and like all things, you know, one thing leads to another. We wanted to use the guy who did that voice on this X product or whatever it was, because that was a successful campaign. So bit by bit, you know, it just sort of builds up. And I was very conscious of keeping on practicing, even though I was starting to get work, because I wanted to get better and better at what I did and really improve the imaging of the characters. That's one reason that I was able to do these international jobs, where they eventually got me to do all the Warner Brothers cartoons for my area of the world when they began expanding. And so
I got to do the rabbit, Mac,
and all of those sort of voices. And then I ended up, you know, being flown to Hollywood, of all things, sort of like the old movie thing come true, and doing this, doing the voice of Bullwinkle in The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle. And it's being produced by, of all people, Robert De Niro. So I'm you know, starry-eyed all of a sudden, because he's playing a silly part in this movie. So Robert De Niro is one of those really accomplished actors who often did projects that, you know, weren't normally a Robert De Niro type of role, like in Goodfellas or something like that, so that he could make money to do his serious jobs. So that was just one of those things where I ended up being, you know, the voice of Bullwinkle, and the original guy who did his voice and was the chief writer was Bill Scott, and he died in, I guess, 1985. I knew him very well, and absolutely no relation. Everyone has assumed that I'm his son or his nephew or something, and there's no relationship at all. But he used to jokingly say, you know, when I'm gone, he said, "Boy, you're going to get the Bullwinkle voice," and that's what happened. That's what I did.
Nice.
So yeah, that's really, again, is one of my long convoluted answers to your question about the first job I ever did. Yeah, it's vivid in my mind.
Awesome. So now, in the 70s, you provided voiceover for many radio and TV commercials by either doing impressions or original voices. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, well, in those days, again, it was, I suppose today, you think of characters like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone, and even more recent ones who've been in the all the, you know, superhero type films. Back in those days, because TV hadn't even got, by the time I started, we were 3 years away from even getting color TV, so that's how long ago it was. They used to run a ton of old movies on TV, like movies from the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. And they were known by every generation, whereas these days it's sort of like fragmented generations. Like, so grandparents and little kids all knew the same actors. So I used to get a ton of calls on these either radio or TV spots, and they wanted to do an impression of some... Do you guys know John Wayne?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
The, excuse me, the cowboy actor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, you know, they do those sort of genre parodies in some of these commercials, like a scene from a cowboy film or something. And so I'd have to do a John Wayne voice, and then they'd also cast me as his offsider. So you end up doing that sort of thing where you're talking to yourself, you know. And it was like, one of these old timers sort of characters like this, and you know, well, that's what we're gonna do. And it was all related to some product or something. I used to do tons of things like that, and that was really about the first 20 years I was doing it before the original legend voices started dying just of old age. So I wasn't even doing any of the matching of famous animation characters back then. But they did, along with the commercials you asked about, there was a nascent cartoon industry beginning here in Australia with a Polish immigrant, an older man who's no longer with us, called Joram Gross. And he came from Poland to Australia and ended up really doing a lot of made for TV cartoon series of, like, you know, 60 episodes each. And the most famous one was this Australian literary property that was around since like the 1920s, but it was about a koala bear and it was called Blinky Bill. And that eventually ended up being the first animated TV series he did in Australia. And myself and a lady named Robin Moore ended up doing all the voices on that, because back in those days, we were the ones most known for doing character voices instead of just like straight announcers doing just their own voice their whole career. So I was ending up in these made for Australia cartoons, which you can now source on the internet. You know, doing kangaroos and platypuses and all these native Australian animals in cartoon form. And so that was a lot of work. That also went for like 20 years, along with the commercials, because there were series after series. He did a series based on, you know, the dolphin Flipper. It was called Flipper and Parker, and there were three series of that. And I was doing, by that stage, it was, you know, like the villain was this mad Dr. Octopus character under the water who wanted to take over the whole island. And so I ended up doing, in the audition for that, I did a kind of a Jack Nicholson, crazy Jack Nicholson voice, and they caricatured it to almost look like Jack Nicholson's face. And so I got that kind of part in that, and he was just this crazy, crazy villain, you know? So it's just been a life of all this zany voices like that, you know, that built up. But yeah, really, that was it. A lot of it was day-to-day work. You'd get a call, and you'd go in, and you wouldn't even know until you saw the script what they were going to do. It was because there wasn't any instant communication like the mobile phones and the internet of today. Often it would have been too much, you know, to mail something to your house in advance. And it was just, a lot of it was just like they'd write something the day before and say, oh, these guys who are experts, they'll know what to do. And so you'd turn up, and we used to love that as performers, because it was a challenge to be creative. It was like you were thinking on your feet and creating on the spot, and they'd say, we want a villainous character for this guy, and this one is like a pure superhero type, and or some of the girls would get, this is a real old battle axe of a woman who's yelling at these guys. So you'd come up with, a lot of it was cartoony sort of characters, but you were really thinking on your feet, and your brain was, it was sort of like what they'd call instant interpretation. You'd be handed something cold. And if you were really experienced at it, you'd end up also getting a lot of work, because you were in and out of the studio fairly quickly and onto another one, which saved them money. You know, you think of whatever a studio might have cost back then, say $200 an hour or something. If you weren't quick and you made them go over the hour, they you know, they're paying an extra $200, whatever the equivalent of that is today. It'd be a lot more. So yeah, that was a kind of like a lot of what the day-to-day work was like back then. Really hasn't changed either. I'm sure it's the same now, you know, for any young folk getting into it.
Right. And before we continue with the next question, here is our other co-host, Matt Bingle.
Hello, Matt. How are you? I'm Keith.
I'm doing good, Keith. How are you?
Good. Not too bad at all.
Oh, terrific. Real good. Terrific.
Terrific. So,
how are you, Matt?
I'm good, Jakey.
Yes.
I'm glad to be here.
Yes. Happy I made it.
Yeah, so to continue this, so you've also made many appearances on TV shows as a comic impressionist. Can you share any of those experiences?
Well, really, that's back in the days when they had what they call variety shows. I think it's pretty rare to see it on TV these days. But back then it was quite common. You were either a straight stand-up comic or a comedy impressionist, and I fell into the latter category. And there were these crazy shows. Remember, there was an Australian one called Hey, Hey, It's Saturday, which was very irreverent.
Oh, yeah.
And right. Yeah, and anything goes sort of thing, you know. Again, a little ahead of its time. It sort of came along around about the time of The Simpsons, and there was just this change in humor the whole world over, you know, and comedy clubs and things began appearing. Excuse me. And so back then, apart from local political characters and TV personalities, I'd be doing some, you know, famous American ones at that time. I remember doing, you know, President Ronald Reagan, as I said to Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall, you know, and all stuff like this that you know, would be very topical back then. But of course, topical humor is one of the worst things of all because it dates so quickly. There, a lot of comedians who did voices like that would recycle certain jokes because politicians are always the same no matter which new ones come along, you know. So of course, yeah, around about the end of the period, just about the beginning of the pandemic when COVID hit, we were all having a lot of fun with Donald Trump because even then he was still the president and doing all of this sort of crazy stuff. And now it's the same again, I suppose, with Joe Biden, because, you know, it's almost like shooting fish in a barrel, you know, with him, because you can get a bit unintentionally cruel because of his age, I think. It was like, I want to be clear. Where am I? Have him falling asleep every sentence. So yeah, it was like pretty much just that sort of thing. But I would do I mean, there's bits and pieces you can see on my website of the stuff that I would do. I think there's even a clip from way back in the 80s of me doing a bunch of cartoon voices in front of a live audience, one straight after the other, and that was a routine that people kept asking me to do because it was unusual. You know, it was real rapid fire voice changes, and just real nonsense, of course. It didn't make any point, but often that was the sort of comedy people wanted on TV in those days. Just something silly, zany, funny, and it didn't have to be making any sort of political points. I think the world has now moved so fast with what's happening these days that it's more expected that you're going to, you know, comment on current events rather than just nonsense. But comedy's always evolving anyway. But yeah, it was pretty much just like if you can ever remember seeing any of those guys who did, you know, quick voice changes on TV in a stand-up sort of a role, or, you know, you'd still see him at comedy clubs. That was pretty much what I was doing in those days as the adjunct to my other anonymous career of doing voiceover work. So definitely. It's just been this set of tonsils of mine that's been worked to the bone for 45 years doing all this nonsense and zany stuff.
So you've also done a bunch of stand-up shows at different corporate events. Can you talk a bit about doing that?
Yeah, the corporate field for a while, it's almost a bit dated now. Unless they get young comics, the corporate field events tend to have a certain age group. And of course, I was that much younger back then when it all started, because it was a burgeoning field back then. There was a lot of comedians would be hired because they'd have some event, whether it was an awards night, some black tie, you know, big get together. A client meeting. Sometimes you'd lump the term corporate into so many offshoots. There'd be a little sales meeting of 20 people in some room with just drinks, no seats or anything, everyone just standing, and they'd still want a little bit of entertainment at these things. So they'd either get a comedian or a mimic like myself, or it could be one of those big, important black tie nights where everyone from every state congregates in, say, Sydney, at a big ballroom, and they're all dressed to the nines, and it's a big three-course dinner type thing. So, you know, the term corporate really does encompass all of that that sort of thing. It's just a generic term, really, for anything that's not a show for the general public, like in a club, you know, but more of a business-oriented thing. And yet you're still dealing with people who in their private life would be going to a club anyway with their family. So the only thing is occasionally on those things, they'd ask you to tailor something in your show and mention some of the people there. And I used to find that was counterproductive, really. You know, they would think it would be a great joke, and they'd give you a list of maybe 20 people who work there, and they'd say, now this guy is fat, and this guy is a real, you know, he thinks he's a ladies' man and all of that. And of course, these days, you've got to be watch out because of the, you know, all the changes that have come along since then, that you could literally offend somebody. The humor back then was pretty raw, but I used to find that didn't work because, it was obvious that you didn't know these people, whereas they all knew them. They saw them every day of their working life. And you had to be pretty careful that what these guys assumed you were going to say something really funny about their friends who'd then get a big laugh. I heard about a lot of comedians who did that, and they'd do something and the person got really offended, you know, and embarrassed, and his family was there and they got embarrassed, and these guys had originally thought it was going to be, oh, this hilarious, you know, we'll make fun of his weight or something like this, you know. So I very quickly learned to say no to that and say, listen, I'll say something that I'll work out that's very harmless and still, you know, we'll get a bit of a giggle. And But mostly I just said, look, I prefer just to do my own, you know. And mostly on corporate things also, they only wanted like 20 minutes because it was the best time of night strategically for your performance would be going on straight after the main course of the dinner before they got too drunk, you know. So it had its advantages and its disadvantages. The advantage of corporate work was that it paid much better than normal clubs. The disadvantage was all of those other things I just mentioned. Sometimes you could be reported unfavorably just because one person might have taken offense at something you said about their product or something, right, and you meant it as a harmless joke, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yep. I'm sorry. That's not in a soundproof studio, so that'll ring for a couple of minutes, and then I did a Bullwinkle voice on the answer machine to ward off telemarketers. It's an old landline.
I like that. That's cool.
Nice. And no worries. We don't really hear it as much.
No, we don't really hear it. So you're good.
Well, I just, the tag of it, if you can hear him in the background, is Bullwinkle saying, if you're a member of the family or a friend, kindly leave a message. If you're a telemarketer, kindly take a hike. And then, you can just hear now. It's beep, 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 beep. So obviously I've offended some telemarketer.
That's great.
So for many years, you worked on a number of projects in the Blinky Bill franchise, voicing Flat the Platypus, Blodge the Kangaroo, and various others. Now, us Americans, we may not be, I'm familiar with it, but maybe most of our audience isn't familiar with the Blinky Bill franchise. Could you kind of describe what it was about and what that was like for you?
It was great. I mean, it was, as I say, Joram Gross Studios' first foray into television. They'd done about four or five feature-length animated films using this technique that he kind of... really, I guess he invented it. It was like live action backgrounds, but the animated characters performed against for the whole film. That was done away with once it went to TV, because then it was just like normal looking cartoon. It had hand painted backgrounds and so on. But anyway, it was this famous book from way back in the 20s, The Adventures of Blinky Bill, about a mischievous koala, like a naughty little boy, I guess. But it was like a traditional animation thing, very much to do with just Australian stuff back then. I think, when did the internet really begin? I guess you could say very late 90s, maybe mid 90s. So this again preceded that by about 5 years. So again, it was most unusual for any international, unless they picked it up and played it, you know. Australia wasn't as easily contactable back in the days of, you know, pre-Zoom and all everything that we've got these days. But somebody said that at least in California, I think it was played on a couple of local stations that used to get content from all over the world. And that built up kind of a cult following, because what I did with those cartoons was I knew it. A lot of his stuff was aimed at the very young, you know, like the ages from, say, 6 to 12. That was the intended age group of all of his series. It was always, you know, shown after school hours in the afternoon. But I knew a lot of parents were watching. And from my experience when I was a kid, I remembered, you know, getting frustrated when I used to love Rocky and Bullwinkle, but my mother would be in the same room either ironing clothes or doing something, and she'd be laughing at jokes that I didn't get. So that really frustrated me, knowing that I had to wait a few years to really get all the humor, because it was just aimed, you know, a couple of things were just aimed at the adults, just to go over the heads of the little kids. The kids were enjoying the adventure aspect, but so I tried with a lot of the voices, not just the regular ones like the kangaroo and the platypus, but any one-off characters that appeared in just one episode. I tried to do impersonations of voices that would be recognized or funny to the parents. I remember in one there was three villains, and I did one of them as a local politician, and the other two I did do as Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone, just because they were really hot at that time in the movies. And so one was a very, you know, big beefy looking, I think it was like a bull maybe,
and so I gave him a voice like Sylvester Stallone, you know, all right, yeah.
And the other one, another big character was like Arnold, you know. It's like, go on, get to the chopper now. And all this, and the other one was just a little tiny rat, and I did him as the Prime Minister of Australia, you know, like a politician. And the kids wouldn't have known; they just thought they were funny voices. But I used to get a lot of mail from the parents saying, "We enjoy your little contributions, because we can happily watch the cartoons with our kids and have a few laughs for ourselves." So that became my philosophy for the 20 or so years I was with that studio here, to do something for the older part of the audience who'd be accompanying the little kids that it was aimed at, you know. So I remember in the platypus had this duck bill. That's what they look like. And so I gave it like an Australian version of Daffy Duck, where he couldn't, you know, pronounce the S without that lisp.
Well, it sounded sort of like an Australian version of Daffy Duck.
And the kangaroo was again based on a politician who couldn't pronounce the letter R properly. Like he'd talk about, instead of saying radical free market reform, he'd go radical free market reform. Well, I made that big tall kangaroo, I just exaggerated that voice, and I made him a little bit like that. Oh, come on, Blinky, we're going down to the crocodile farm, you know. So I'd take anything in popular culture like comics do right now, you know, and it would be just fodder for making a funny character voice out of, you know. So it was like basically, again, until you turn up to a session for a half hour cartoon like that, you don't really know on the first episode what it's going to be like. But those characters are usually worked out for a couple of recording sessions where you're auditioning, and then the director will say, just add this to it or take that little bit out, so that they're kind of set by the time you actually start production, and they don't alter, you know, like three or four episodes later. They're kind of set from the beginning. You know, in the old days of the famous cartoons like Bugs Bunny, you can, if you watch them chronologically, you can hear the early Bugs.
It was kind of a lot more subdued and kind of a tough little stinker like that. And then later on, it became what's up, Doc?
You know, so they developed. Even Bullwinkle, when he started, he was a lot lower and a lot less energetic. And then he became the Bullwinkle that we all know. So they do, you know, they did change slightly until they settled in. But these days, a lot of the series worked out pretty much from the start. So they, and the same with advertising, you know, you tend to have so many committees there who'll sit in on an audition and they all have their 2 cents worth to throw in. So you do end up with a character that pretty much stays the same. I'm thinking about some of those old days where the great Dawes Butler did those Cap'n Crunch commercials for the cereal, you know, and they went for like 25 years. And that voice didn't vary from commercial one right up to the end when he passed away. So, yeah, it really was a lot of experimentation.
Definitely.
Sometimes, yeah, and sometimes you might use like a movie star voice and then exaggerate it. I remember there was a series we did called Tabaluga about a little dragon. I think that was a German literary property originally, because by that time in the last 10 years of that studio here, they were all co-productions, or they called them co-pros, where they'd be getting funding from Europe, so they'd be either German or French co-productions with Australian animation. And so one of them had a villainous snowman, and he had a little offsider that they had called James in the script. And and so the old guy, Yoram Gross, said, just do James Mason, you know. So James Mason had this sort of a voice, and he was a very distinguished old English actor. And, of course, suddenly it became a very funny little voice for a tiny little penguin cartoon character that was very obsequious and sort of, oh, yes, Your Majesty, of course, I'll immediately go and do that for you. Don't beat me. No. I'll do. So, you know, what was a serious actor in films ended up becoming this zany little character in the cartoon using this very distinguished voice. And it became a funny contrast, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Yeah.
Going back to Bullwinkle J. Moose, as you mentioned, you were his voice actor for 20 years. What was it like getting to work on the Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle movie?
Well, that I guess that's like the dream of anyone in showbiz like myself. You know, you never think it's going to happen. But first of all, it was the thing that got me interested in, when I was a six-year-old, in doing voices, Rocky and Bullwinkle and all the Jay Ward Productions cartoons. I used to love the Fractured Fairy Tales and Dudley Do-Right, the crazy, you know, Mountie, Canadian Mountie. And so I was doing all of those characters, never dreaming that I'd end up not only as the voice of them, but being flown to Hollywood. It's sort of like one of those old movies where you know, the actor gets sick on opening night and the young understudy takes over the role and becomes a star. For a little while there, I was getting all this international work, and then one thing leads to another. They flew me to Canada to do the voice of... after that movie, it was the voice of Diesel, the villainous train in the Thomas the Tank Engine thing. And that one didn't work out. It was like one of those situations where I did this whole thing. They flew me to Toronto to record it. They had a test screening. This is like in the year 2000, I think. And apparently the villain I did scared all the little kids. So I got fired from that job. And they got somebody else. I don't know how you make a villain less scary, but somebody must have. But I based the voice on the old Disney cartoon from way back in the 30s, Three Little Pigs. And the big bad wolf had this, I'm going to huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house down. You know? And that's all I did. But, you know, now they're saying the kids got scared at the preview. So maybe they had kids of like three or four there. I don't know. I mean, really, before Rocky and Bullwinkle, even though that was such a great experience for me, the first one that they flew me to Hollywood to do was narrating the first George of the Jungle with Brendan Fraser, who has made a huge comeback. I mean, he just won an Oscar, I think. If you saw that film, that was based on this very short run Jay Ward series from 1967, George of the Jungle with Super Chicken and Tom Slick. It was only, I think they only did 17 half hours, but each of them was narrated by an actor called Paul Frees, who had a great Orson Welles sort of a voice. And it was like, and the mighty Bumbashooty Valley in Mbwebwe Province in Africa, George of the Jungle. And of course he had died by then. And she asked if I would like to narrate the movie in his voice. And so that I always remembered, you know, auditioning for it by the technology then, I think with 1997, it was called ISDN. It preceded Zoom, but it was basically, they'd perfected, the fact that you could hook up 14,000 miles from Sydney to Los Angeles, audio only. And, it sounded like you were in the same room, you know, so that became a commonplace thing. Now, I think that was the beginning of where globalizing the industry really started back then, you know, because you could go anywhere in the world, or at least the English-speaking world, if you're talking about cartoons, and share the talent from England or New Zealand or America or wherever it might be, Canada. So the George of the Jungle, I remember doing that one, and the live action with Brendan Fraser was the same as the opening of the old George of the Jungle TV cartoon, because the song was, you know, watch out for that tree, as he's doing the Tarzan sort of, then he slams headfirst into these trees because he's such a klutz. And I love the opening line in my narration of that first movie, because it was like, and this is George of the Jungle. You see him swinging, and you just know he's going to head face first into this gigantic tree. And he's doing that scream. And I say, he is swift. He is strong. He is sure. Crash. And he falls unconscious. He is unconscious. So that was, and the other bit I loved in that movie was where they really captured the Jay Ward sort of humor really well, in just this bit where these two animal poachers, who were the villains, I'm describing them, and you can hear my disembodied voice saying, these mean, sneaky animal poachers. And one of the guys, a big chubby guy, looks up to the sky and says, stop calling me that, you know. So I will not. So it was like this breaking this wall of a narrator from somewhere up above in the sky. They're hearing him in the movie. I mean, just so silly, but such good fun, you know.
Absolutely.
So you also got to voice Popeye and Bluto for the Universal ride, Popeye uh-huh. and Bluto's Wise Rat Barges. Yes, try yes. saying that five times fast. What was that like?
Gee, it's that now. That's a while ago, because in those days, the Jay Ward characters like Bullwinkle and George of the Jungle, everything, they were being licensed for a few years by Universal Studios, and at that same time, they'd opened this big theme park in Florida to try and match what Universal in Hollywood was like, you know, whether you go on the studio tour and all of that. But in Florida, they had even more intricate rides. And it was really around about 1997, 98, the beginning of the modern technology where rides were real experiences. And so they tried to get the, you know, as close as they could to the original voices for people who could remember the old black and white Max Fleischer Popeye cartoons, which were really grungy and sort of street smart, you know, way ahead of, I guess, pre-code cartoons. Yeah. Some of the jokes in them you couldn't get away with today because they were outrageous, you know. But I do remember I'd always done a Popeye voice, and they were always looking for people who could do Popeye, because it was a tough voice to maintain, or you'd have to do it in separate takes, because and have a sip of water between. But it was like,
I loves you, Olive,
you know, and
but women is always bad luck on a cruise ship.
And the old Bluto was this huge guy with he had a bass singer doing his voice. And
so he was sort of like, you, why you dirty little fool, take that, why I oughta.
And so it was like, I had to jump from one of those voices to the other for this ride. Unfortunately, I think those rides still exist. At the same session I was doing, there was a Dudley Do-Right ride. I think it was called Ripsaw Falls or something. And of course, these were like miniature adventures. You're on the ride and the cartoon characters are doing something as you're watching. And so along with the Popeye voice and the Bluto,
I was doing Dudley Do-Right of the Mounties.
You know, and there was also one with Boris and Bullwinkle. So it was, again, all these offshoots of doing the film. I think the late June Foray and myself used to work a lot where she was the oldest actor left from that generation. She was still doing Rocky and Natasha in those days, and I got to work with her a lot. And that again, that's a thrill because you're working with one of the legends you grew up listening to. And we ended up doing not only all those rides in theme parks, but voices for slot machines in Las Vegas and all these little offshoots that you don't think of, you know, that the characters can be used on. So it really was a great ride while it lasted. Then the characters, I guess they kind of fell out of favor when a new generation was born and grew up, because there was all these new characters and cartoons coming along that and for a while there, I think, certainly before YouTube, that generation that I grew up with, like Bugs Bunny and all those things, fell out of view unless you bought DVD collections. They just weren't on TV anywhere for a long time. Now I guess they're back on MeTV and those things, but now they've also discovered how to restore these old 1930s cartoons so that they look brand new, which is great. Then along comes a generation of cartoons for really tiny kids like Dora the Explorer. And you think, okay, I've been in this business a long time. I don't think I'm going to start working on these voices. They just wouldn't suit me at all. But that's just the way the business goes.
Right.
It's always reinventing.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. So on the subject of rides and attractions, you also got to voice a number of the Looney Tunes characters for various attractions. What were those like?
That was great because, with the parents and grandparents who attended with kids, they all grew up with these cartoons in theaters, even before television came along. And so it was great doing those ones because they were so famous. They're now legendary, you know, and I'd be doing, well, a lot of those were those sort of theme parks that you go to, and then there's a theater, and they would have, I guess they still do this. It's a big time thing. I did about 20 years of this too. It was for the Hanna-Barbera characters and for the Warner Brothers characters, where you do all the voice track, and it was like an adventure or something on stage, and it was performed by all these dancers who'd get up in costumes of Huckleberry Hound or Bugs Bunny or whatever it was, Tweety and Sylvester. And it'd be like 500 people in this theater, you know, from little kids to their parents, watching these productions. My part of it ended months earlier because I was just on the soundtrack of it all, but you'd be singing and you'd be doing all this shtick back and forth with the, you know, Sylvester, like, fuck-a-tash. Of course, you had to do it pretty loudly and broadly because you were doing it for a live presentation in a big theater with a huge audience. So it had to be just as crazy and broad as the old cartoons to reach everyone, you know. And it also had to be just paced slightly slower than normal because if you did it at the crazy pace of a cartoon, a lot of it would get lost because of people laughing and you'd miss the next line. So you learned how to time it for that medium. It was just a different discipline slightly, but it was still, it had to still sound exactly like Sylvester or...
Bugs Bunny.
Right.
Yep. So you also got to provide the voice, speaking of voices, for Homer Simpson for The Simpsons live on stage at Dreamworld. For you American Boy. Viewers, Dreamworld is like Australia's yes. big theme park.
Right, yeah. Yeah. That's right. I'd forgotten that I even did that, but it was because they approved, I think on some demo I had, there was just me just doing a little bit of a little bit of Homer Simpson. And they said, yeah, no, we'll approve that guy to do it down under, you know. You had to make sure that you went to every channel. I remember also doing something for Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble, and that was DreamWorks. Then were licensing that, so they had to approve me. Then when Shrek came along, I had to do Shrek and Donkey. I remember it took a while to get Shrek, you know, because it was like this Scottish thing, and I kept defaulting into doing Billy Connolly for some reason. but Eddie Murphy was a good one because the character he did in that was so mimicable. It was like, what was the line where he said, you know, I really like you, Shrek, you know. you're a mean, green, fat machine. Together we're going to scare the spit out of anybody that crosses us. You know, so he was a great one to do. But now I find that, like, with your generation, you guys have grown up with so much media because of the internet and all of this, that now there's people that are all around the world who can do Homer Simpson and often do it better than some of the actors because they've studied it so long. It's sort of like, it's just the way things progress, I guess. It's just technology. But it's just been really interesting to somebody like me that it used to be so anonymous and so mysterious to people, and now everyone knows about voiceovers and things, you know. So right. That quick thing with the Homer thing was he actually didn't really have that many lines from memory because a lot of it was just songs, you know, and again, aiming at that younger demographic, a lot of it is just that sort of where you have a live host with the characters in their costumes next to them and they're all singing and dancing and doing all this sort of stuff. They're a kind of corny thing in one sense, but that's because they're dealing with kids of 3 and 4 who are accompanying their parents at the park. So it's like, that's who it's aimed at, you know? So you just go with the flow and you do it. And it would be interesting to see a real, I think the best thing I ever saw on a live stage about The Simpsons was that guy who could do every voice, and he was touring the world, you know, doing Shakespeare or a Shakespearean play with every voice, like he did Homer and Marge and Bart and all. I can't think of his name. It was quite funny. But it was definitely for an adult audience, or it was actually really for actors, because it was very much a theater piece, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So moving on from voice acting, in 2000, you published your first book, The Moose Yes. That Roared. Could you kind Right. of talk about what the book's about?
Well, that book is the entire history of J. Ward Productions. I mean, you know, Bullwinkle's on the cover because he definitely was their most famous character. But it was something that I, again, I've always been a really serious researcher of old films and old-time radio and all these topics. And when I got to know all my heroes, like Bill Scott and Doris Butler and all these people, they all said, gee, you know so much about this stuff that we've done that we've forgotten. And Bill Scott said, gee, one day I predict you'll write a book about us. Well, he died in 1985, but I was, you know, when he said that, I was only like 19 or 20, and I was thinking, what's he talking about? I could never do that, but I did. Yeah,
yep.
back, you know, in my late 40s, I published the book, and it, apparently it's more popular now, strangely enough, with cartoon buffs than I had even thought it would be if it was a good book, because it was published in the year 2000, as you said, and it was deliberately timed to coincide with when the movie, The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle, opened. I think the publishing company got together with the movie people and said, this is a good marketing thing. We can have the book come out, you know. So that all worked out really well. Unfortunately, the Rocky and Bullwinkle movie kind of tanked a bit. One problem was that the original guys who sponsored the cartoons from back in the 60s was a cereal company, General Mills, you know, Cheerios and all these cereals. And they were not playing ball with Universal, who had the rights to the characters. They still owned the shows. So there was all this corporate bickering about money and all this. And so the cartoons hadn't been on TV for about, 15 years when the movie came out. They started to run a few of them on, I think, Bravo or one of those cable channels. But it wasn't enough because the main audience for, you know, national television just hadn't seen. So the parents and the grandparents remembered them, but the kids had no idea who Rocky and Bullwinkle were when the movie came out, which was a real problem and a disappointment to us. It didn't do as well as it could have. Whereas the cartoons that had stayed on TV when they were made into movies, like the Flintstones or Scooby-Doo, they were so successful that they ended up making sequel after sequel, you know, and so there you go. It's just a luck of the draw. And yet it has become a kind of a little cult thing, you know, over the years since. So right. I can't complain too much.
Yeah,
George of the Jungle was really successful.
Oh, yeah.
And yet they didn't even know the cartoons. But I think that song was so memorable. George, George, George of the Jungle. You know, that everyone in the world would walk out of the theater singing it, you know. So, and also I think that just came along at a time. And it was done by Disney quite well with Brendan Fraser. And it just worked.
Great
movie. Yeah.
Great movie. So,
mind you, the sequel really sucked.
Yeah. as it is with most Disney sequels, you know.
Yeah, well, it went straight to DVD. It didn't even go into theaters.
Yeah, a lot of the shade to the people who worked on them, but a lot of their direct-to-video sequels aren't the greatest. There's some good ones, but usually it's always the originals that people go back to.
Oh, I knew when I was working on it because they got me back to narrate that one, and I was thinking, oh, this is not good. And and they couldn't get Brendan Fraser too. Like, he was becoming quite big by then. He'd done films like Gods and Monsters and things like that, so he didn't want to repeat as George.
Yeah,
but anyway, it you know, it's made its money back. I think I get a residual check of like 60 cents every couple of years from the sequel. But the first one was a big success, and strangely enough, that's what people remembered me for in Hollywood, not the Bullwinkle one, even though Bullwinkle was still a much more long running remembered property, you know.
Right. So, as we're kind of getting to the last questions here, recently you published a new book all about the history of animation voices of the Golden Age. Oh, yes. How did that come about?
Yes, this is the book here. It's called Cartoon Voices of the Golden Age. And it's a study of something that was a hobby of mine for many, many years, researching my own field and going way back to the beginning of sound films. And it's really more of an historical book because it shows you how voice acting for animation developed as an art form. It started out where Walt Disney, the most famous name in animation, was the first ever cartoon voice of the very primitive Mickey Mouse when sound first came into films. And so the book traces the development of six major studios like Disney, Warner Brothers, etc., who did theatrical cartoons, and how for the first 3 or 4 years of sound cartoons, all the voices were being done by the staff members. You know, they had no idea about hiring professional voice actors. It was just animators or background artists would come in and squeak and do a grunt for a mouse or something like that. So, mind you, the gags were still pretty out there and funny in some of those early ones. But then they slowly began using singing groups who were very practiced at doing character voices in song, especially the bass singers who would do good villains. And then suddenly, like 1937, about 9 years into sound films, they start using radio actors, and that was the year that Mel Blanc, who has still never been topped in the field, became a voice at Warner Brothers and eventually their star voice. You know, he ended up doing Foghorn Leghorn and all the secondary characters that have become famous, Yosemite Sam, all these great voices. So it really traces it from that point. In the book, it talks about Mel Blanc and then Doris Butler and then Stan Freberg and all these other great legendary names. But I also managed to do a lot of research at some of the archives where Warner Brothers donated all their papers, for instance, at USC, and found a whole bunch of names of uncredited actors, because in those days you never saw the actor's name on the screen. And so the what I'm really proud of with this newer book is that I've uncovered about over 100 people who were anonymous until I found out their names and have identified them. And, you know, if their family ever finds out, they might get a little glow of recognition, but it means nothing for people who died 50 years ago. But
yeah.
But anyway, it's a book that I'm glad I was able to do and complete. In fact, it was taking me 30 years to do it and research it, because it was always a part-time thing, that one. And then when COVID came along, and for the first year or so, I was just housebound, couldn't travel, couldn't work in any clubs or anything. That's when I thought, oh, damn, I'm going to complete this book and get it off my mind, you know, or I'll never publish it.
Right. So the last question that Jake here is about to ask is a question we ask all of our guests at the end. Go ahead, Jake.
Sure.
Thank you, Chris. So, of course, this podcast is called Jake's Happy Nostalgia. There you go. When you think of nostalgia, what do you think of, or in your own words, how would you define the word nostalgia?
Well, it's a huge thing for me because my whole life has been nostalgia. I was born in mid-century, and yet all of my interests go back to, I just fell in love with nostalgia because there was a show when I was about 10 years of age called Hollywood and the Stars, about 26 episodes, half hour. And each episode covered a different topic, but it went right back to Al Jolson in The Jazz Singer, the first talkie film and all of that. And something snapped in me and I started collecting old movie books and things. I was just a kid. So that unlike every other kid my age, I wasn't into sport or anything like that. I was just this, the original super geek or super nerd who loved all the nostalgic stuff. And I still look back and love that era. Things were probably a little more simple back then and not so technologically advanced, so that I think a lot of good stuff was done because they didn't have any of today's tools and they still managed to make really good entertainment. So I'm very big on nostalgia, and I don't go along with that joke that says nostalgia isn't what it used to be.
Definitely a great word to end on.
Awesome.
Well, thank you, Chris, Jake, and Matt. It's been a pleasure. And
yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for taking the time to do this. Thank you so much for what we've done over the years. You know, keep up the great work, and cannot wait what's next in store for you.
Thank you very much. And this is the first time I've used this little plug-in USB mic. Was my voice clear on this?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, it was.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's good.
Yes, it was.
Because I'm so non-technical that I was using the inbuilt mic on the computer and it sounded a bit dull to me. So
Yeah.
Oh, great. Uh-huh. All righty. Terrific. All right. Well, I will chat with you guys at some point, I'm sure, in the future. But
definitely.
Thank
definitely.
You.
Yeah.
Thank
yeah,
you.
So enjoy the rest of your day. I'll let you know when this goes up.
Terrific. And I'll hit the leave button and say,
that's all, folks.
It's goodbye from us as well, everybody. You absolutely enjoyed our time with Keith Scott. Keep on the lookout for more wonderful interviews coming your way. Link to his website will be included in the description.
Yes.
And links to where you can purchase a copy of his books. But yes, again, like I just said, keep on the lookout for more wonderful interviews coming your way. As always, what do we say, Jake?
Keep nostalgia alive. Take care, everyone. See you next time. Bye.
Bye.
See ya.
Thank you for tuning in to another wonderful Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show interview. Be sure to follow Jake and the crew on social media and stream the show wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And as always, remember to keep nostalgia alive. Bye-bye.